2022 will be remembered, amongst other things, as the year the UK had three prime ministers with three different takes on green policy. Boris Johnson.
We have the tools for a green industrial revolution.
Then, for six turbulent weeks, Liz Truss declaring war on the anti-growth coalition.
I have three priorities for our economy. Growth, growth and growth.
And now, Rishi Sunak.
Rising energy prices across the world are not a reason to go slow on climate change. They are a reason to act faster.
Rishi Sunak's been in office for a little over a month now. Still time enough to trip over a critical environmental yardstick. Attendance at the UN climate talks, COP27 in Egypt. He does have an overflowing in tray with war in Ukraine, inflation, empty government coffers and a struggling NHS. So where will climate and nature sit on his to-do list? And how should the government, to use the word of the moment, deliver for the environment? Deliver in the 2 years left of this parliament, 2 years which could be crucial for the planet. Costing the Earth is in Westminster to discuss just that. Someone who walks both these Whitehall pavements and farm tracks is Adam Vaughan, environment editor of The Times, and we started by talking about Liz Truss's premiership.
It was kind of an extraordinary time. I don't think I've ever known so many unhappy staff at DEFRA wanting to talk to journalists because of how bad the sort of political leadership was there. Ranul, the new environment secretary, came in and he had a team with him who just didn't really seem interested in talking to their experts at the department. They then lurched from crisis to crisis. The mini budget, one of the things that many people didn't notice initially was some language around a review on farming subsidies, this new system of public goods where, you know, you're doing something for nature, for example. And that really just put the cat amongst the pigeons with your RSPBs and your National Trust. They basically perceived it as this is part of an attack on nature. So there was other stuff about dropping retained EU law on air and water pollution and investment zones in protected areas. Anyway, this all built up into a perception that there was an attack on nature.
Truss goes, replaced by Rishi Sunak. What are we seeing now?
Long story short, we've had a bit of back and forth on climate. Sunak obviously initially said he wasn't going to go to COP27 in Egypt. Then he realised that was kind of untenable and he changed his mind. He went. He didn't say a lot, frankly. I think it's good that he went. I don't really think he achieved a lot, if I'm being honest.
Struck me he was slightly closing the door on the accusation that you didn't even go to COP.
Yeah, I think Sunak very much wanted the new to the idea that he was like anti-environment in the same way that Truss's government came across. So I think with the current government now, at best they're neutral, I think, on the environmental agenda. We're kind of halfway between where we were with Johnson, with like pro, and halfway between where we are with Truss, with sort of anti, to put it in really crude terms.
Do you think what happened in the weeks of Liz Truss's premiership will be seen as a bit of a sneeze in the middle of a continuity of environment policy, or a change that was significant?
I think that'll end up being seen as an aberration. The reason I say that is it's just because there's votes in the environment. You know, you look at the YouGov polling of issues that are most important to people in the country. The two top issues you can probably guess, they're the economy and health. The third issue is environment, and that obviously includes climate change, nature, so on. So I think that was a blip.
To make sense of where this administration is headed on the environment and to examine the effect of a turbulent year and certainly a lively last few months, I'm joined by a Tory insider, a Green Observer and a business backer, Sam Hall, Director of the Conservative Environment Network, Chris Venables from the think tank Green Alliance and Nick Mollow, CEO of the Aldersgate Group, a sustainability lobby group whose members turn over more than £500 trillion. Sam Hall, you used to advise Michael Gove when he was running Environment. How have you viewed the roller coaster of recent years and months? Enjoyed the ride?
I have, yeah. I mean, in the immediate aftermath of Brexit, and this was partly led by Michael Gove when he was the Environment Secretary, I think there was a real determination to make the most of the Brexit freedoms to strengthen our environmental protections. And it was under Michael Gove that this new scheme to reward farmers for delivering environmental goods was developed. The Environment Act, which created a new set of legally binding targets, a new watchdog to hold government to account, and environmental law was created. So I think the party had been moving in a very green direction and
had.
Was committed to taking advantage of those Brexit opportunities. I think under Liz Truss, some uncertainty was created about whether some of these policies would continue with, for example, the review of the environmental land management scheme, the new farm subsidy system that had been set in train. But I think the truth is we don't know what would have happened at the end of those reviews. We don't know what actual policy would have changed. I think what we can say is that Liz Truss wanted to move in this more free market direction, and I think had some scepticism about whether regulations, particularly around the environment, would be harmful to growth.
Chris Venables from the Green Alliance, you're an independent and cross-party group, but you must have kind of felt this variable warmth of Tory party leadership towards the green agenda of late.
As Sam said, there has been quite a lot of progress. I think the kind of key is on the side of delivery. We've had a lot of ambition, but we often end up having fights about targets quite far in the future. Mm. And the question, I think, for all of us now, 3 years into this government and with the election on the horizon, what are they going to shout about?
And they get pulled up on delivery quite a lot by the Climate Change Committee, especially, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, holding their feet to the fire on that.
Yeah, the Committee on Climate Change says only out of 8 of 50 indicators are they actually making the progress.
8 of 50?
8 out of 50 of their indicators are they making progress, and they only have the policies in place to deliver 39% of the cuts needed to meet the net zero target. So quite a way to go.
Nick Mollo, did you and your colleagues welcome the supposedly sort of growth and business-friendly agenda of Liz Truss and that free market emphasis?
Interestingly, we didn't really welcome it because we felt that a lot of the narrative that came with it assumed that anything to do with environmental regulation or climate policy was anti-growth, when it's far from the truth. If I was to ask any of our business members at the Aldersgate Group where they see the biggest investment opportunity, they would say in the net zero transition, in a nature restoration transition. There's a huge market opportunity, not just here in the UK, but globally. And I think what the previous government under Liz Truss did not appreciate is that a significant amount of the investment required to hit net zero, to hit our environmental goals, can come from the private sector. But you will only get that investment if you provide clear public policy signals. And they really did not do a great job of that.
We'll come to that clarity piece in a moment. But in environment policy terms, perhaps the single most disruptive decision taken by the Truss administration was announcing this review of ELMs. We heard a little bit about it earlier. The environmental land management schemes, which are supposed to lead our farmland in a more nature and climate friendly direction. Announcing a review fueled speculation that the government felt the pendulum had swung too far from supporting food production. Farmers are still waiting for the review to be published. So in the meantime, I went west. I'm in mid-Devon and a glorious autumn day. Golden light bathing, absolutely illuminating the trees. And I'm with Dorette Engie and Ollie Walker, who are landowners in this area. Dorette, what plans have you got for this place?
Well, it's a rewilding site, and so I guess it has plans for itself. We are just trying to support as much complexity in life as possible. This is the pond we prepared for the three beavers we got with this Natural England license. So we made a 60-acre enclosure, which then also holds the pigs and the ponies and maybe some of Ollie's cows. And it was a very overgrown plantation who hadn't been looked after. We've taken out as much of the sika spruce as possible. We left the broadleaf plants and we placed them into habitat heaps on two fields. So that would be like a refuge for small animals, but it also would be like a cage for trees to regenerate naturally. We've done it for 2 years to just see what's happening in 2 years. It's quite phenomenal and it's a real joy.
So I'm an organic Pasture for Life certified farmer. Yeah, we raise beef and lamb.
And is that some of that rewilding actually going to spill over into your property?
I can say through mapping that 20% of my land is in a state of rewilding. And we can say that many small family farmers in the UK are actually a microcosm. They have so many different rich habitats on. So joining up those habitats is really possible. And if also farmers can be paid to take their foot off the gas, so to speak, then we really are in a good position for carbon and biodiversity.
What have you been thinking in the last few weeks and months?
I feel there's a lot of confusion in the air about ELMs going forward, and there's a lot of indecision, and that isn't going to help farmers make critical decisions, especially in the face of a changing climate.
Look, I was thinking as we were talking about this, that actually this should not be the right or the of government to be able to change something so quickly. I think elms or all these land, the land management schemes which are supported by the government need to be long term, because farmers work long term.
I suppose it could well be that what happened in September during Liz Truss's premiership, this kind of review of elms, it might end up just being a bit of a wobble.
Yeah.
But does it still have an impact, even if it's just a wobble?
What I hear is that people feel really concerned and worried that if there's one wobble, there might be another wobble.
This is our field called Great Moor. It's been managed through regenerative grazing practice, giving it a very long rest period between the grazing events.
And on the edge of this field, there's a slight slope, and in the evening sun, our shadows are stretching out, 40 metres over there. But there's a beautiful golden green hedge there, which is quite high. It's quite shaggy and bushy. I guess that's deliberate.
Absolutely. There's 7 years' growth on that hedge. It hasn't seen the flail. It's beautiful because a lot of the species that were hidden and really had their wings clipped are now coming to the fore. Things like the silver birch. We'll be able to pick every 20 metres an oak to be a hedgerow tree. It is a marvel, and I can tell you that the cows love the browse. You know, when they can come in here and they can pick some mineral-rich delights from that salad bar, they are very happy.
I mean, it is actually a strip of woodland almost, rather than a hedge. It's that big.
Absolutely. And the future plan would be to bring that woodland more into the field through an agroforestry project, to put every 30 metres an avenue of trees, possibly working with something like goat willow, which is native, if only elms would support that. So we hope that the clarity will be there in future for the agroforestry.
But is that exactly the sort of scheme that you might be thinking of? But when you hear kind of doubts over elms, you suddenly think, hey, well, maybe I shouldn't be putting my money in that.
I would be hedging my bets if I went ahead and did that work right now. I would be paying the labour and I would be grafting myself to make that happen. We need government to put their money where their mouth is.
Ollie Walker and Dorette Enge. Of course, some farmers would welcome a focus on food, not flowers, but Chris Venables from Green Alliance. It seemed to me that even this end of the farming spectrum was more confused than enthused about this review.
I think that's right. I mean, it's a great shame, isn't it, that one of the kind of big uniting agendas of both Leavers and Remainers was agricultural reform. It was this amazing thing that everyone was quite, excited to get out of the CAP, the EU farming policy, which was incredibly destructive. It's disappointing that 6 years on, we still don't have that clarity. I think we can find ways to kind of forgive that in a sense. We had those Brexit years, which were incredibly complicated, and then we had a pandemic. And I suppose the question is now for Sunak and Hunt, what can they do over the next 18 months to actually lock in a bit of change?
Sam, any clues about what this review is likely to yield? I mean, it's still in place. Do you think it'll be upheaval, tinkering, or just quietly buried?
I don't think that there will be major changes to the environmental ambition of the scheme. I think, the underlying rationale for the reform still holds and still very important. Yes, there have been these heightened concerns about food security in part caused by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But we know that our food production domestically depends on having healthy nature. It depends on abundant pollinators. It depends on healthy soil and clean and abundant water.
Do you think the government's ambitions for elms and the amount of money behind it will survive the other demands on government finance?
Yes, I think it will survive. I think the money has been confirmed now in the most recent autumn statement, so we know that it's definitely going to be in place for the rest of this parliament. I think it's critical that when the Conservative Party comes to designing its next manifesto, it provides, again, the same funding guarantee to farmers so that there is plenty of money in the schemes to enable the transition and to sufficiently incentivise and reward these practices that they want to see.
Nick Mollo, I suspect the plea we heard from those farmers that would be very familiar to you from a business perspective was long-term clarity.
Yeah, that's indeed the case. I mean, we do have a degree of clarity in some sectors. So, if you want to develop an offshore wind farm, we have quite well-developed market mechanisms called contract for differences that guarantee a price for the generation of renewable energy, which helps attract investment. But in many other sectors, such as buildings, where there's a huge lack of investment in energy efficiency, or transport or heavy industry, there's a real lack of policy clarity. And that's a problem for two reasons. The first problem is that unless you have clear policy signals, you won't attract the private investment you need. But the other one is around costs. So just to give you an example, a few years ago, Energy UK, the energy trade body, looked at what influenced the cost of offshore wind. And they found that for every 1% reduction in the cost of finance to finance an offshore wind project, which is very closely correlated to an investor's perception of policy risk, you could reduce the cost of an offshore wind project by 6%. So you bring down the cost of finance by 1% through clear policy, you bring down the overall cost of an offshore wind project over its lifetime by 6%.
This sounds very complex, but I think it is very important, because I think I heard this with relation to nuclear as well. One of the reasons that the nuclear is so expensive is the cost of borrowing, if you do it on the open market, is enormous, because the so-called political risk that they factor in, i.e. that government policy may change, so your money all might go down the drain, so you have to charge a lot to borrow that money. Is that basically what we're looking at?
That's basically it, and it's the case across all parts of the of the economy that which we are looking to decarbonize. And in buildings, we still don't have clear regulations in place that mandate that our homes should reach a particular level of energy efficiency by a particular date. Yet that's one of the most immediate things we could do to reduce our exposure to high fossil fuel prices.
A really interesting point, that certainty brings a certain degree of cheapness as well with it. Another big plank of environment policy is energy, as we've just heard. And how do we accelerate the removal of carbon dioxide from electricity and heat? Gus Grand is about to deliver clean power from underground because she's CEO of Eden Geothermal, based in Cornwall.
Geothermal is the heat from beneath our feet. The deeper you go, the hotter it gets. In some places, it gets hotter quicker, and one of those places is Cornwall. So here, it gets hot at about 39 degrees a kilometre. Most places in the UK, it's about 23 degrees a kilometre. But you basically get hot water up out of the ground and then use it for whatever you want. You can use it for electricity, but for that we'd need two wells. At the moment, we've only got one.
Most power stations are actually based on steam, aren't they? Driving turbines, and so you could do the same here, I guess.
You could do the same here. It's the same principle.
The first use for the energy coming out of here will be what?
The first use for the energy coming out of here will be to heat Eden's biomes and some new greenhouses they've put up and the offices, and that will get Eden off gas for heating by spring next year.
And I've just spied, actually, it was the stainless steel wellhead, or the grey wellhead, amongst all that that green structure over there in a container, but it's not at all.
So the well is directly in front of us. It is a person-sized silver structure coming out of the ground. So when it's finished on the heat system, you'll be looking at something about the size of a garage. It's really small. And hopefully when we get to the electricity phase, then you're looking at something that's probably three or four garages, nothing higher than the height of a house.
You clearly think there's enormous potential in the heat beneath the ground. What's holding it back at the moment?
What's holding it back in the UK is, I'm afraid, a policy void. Geothermal is not really recognised, and so we have a problem with investors coming into geothermal, because why would you when there isn't any incentive? In France, there are over 50 geothermal projects under Paris. In Germany, they're ramping it right up. But here in the UK, we're 29th in Europe with geothermal installations, alongside Ukraine, and they've got other things to do at the moment.
And is that because perhaps, well, it's not as economically viable as you'd like people to believe? And maybe, you know, we're better off sticking money into wind or something?
For electricity, wind and solar are certainly cheap, but there's been a big gap in policy looking at heat. And I think that heat is where geothermal will probably go. Every industrial estate needs heat. Hospitals need to be kept warm. There's loads of potential.
You described it as a policy void for geothermal. But does it go kind of a little bit wider than that when it comes to renewable energy and the grid in general?
The grid is a particular problem for us. When we applied for a grid permission, it said that we might be curtailed for up to 68% of the time. You'd be turned off. The UK has put so much solar and wind, which are both intermittent, onto the grid recently, it's creating instability in the grid. So basically, when it's sunny and windy on a summer's day, there's too much electricity on the grid.
What could the government do to address that?
If we're going to get to net zero, 80 to 90% of energy will probably have to be electric. And if you're going to do that, you have to reinforce the grid, and they're not doing it fast enough. I had a letter last week saying that our grid offer may mean that we can't even get onto the grid until 2036. I mean, you know, they're not working to the same urgency that is needed. we really believe that the investment into the grid is not happening at a pace that is compatible with climate change.
Nick Moller, your members exercised, or should I say energised, by this grid issue?
It might sound like a very technical issue, but I think it's actually the biggest problem we have in terms of completing the job on the power sector is what's happening with the grid. So many offshore wind developers, like we've heard with geothermal, are being given a potential connection date 10 years out into the future. That's a long time to wait. But that's partially to do because our planning system at the moment isn't recognising the importance of developing that grid infrastructure fast enough and in a coordinated way so that we can make sure it links up with the huge amount of offshore wind we plan to build over the next 8 years. The other issue we have is we've underinvested in power storage. We've also underinvested in technologies that can help us be a little bit more flexible with the way in which we use electricity. And all of these things together would allow us to curtail renewables less and use renewable electricity more efficiently.
Sam Hall from the Conservative Environment Network. It is true, isn't it, that leaders and politicians, when it comes to energy, they tend to prefer the new big things. You know, let's talk about hydrogen or let's talk about a nuclear power station, not the nuts and bolts and the wires. And they're going to we've heard they do really matter. They're the problem now.
I completely agree. I think there does need to be much more emphasis in unlocking this extra grid infrastructure and also making sure that our regulators like Ofgem are properly embedding net zero into their work. It's not just about short-term consumer prices. It's also about unlocking that long-term investment. I mean, I would say on the general point about politicians' attitudes to renewables, you know, under Conservative governments, we have seen a real rollout of offshore wind. We've got the biggest fleet of offshore wind in Europe. I would like to see, particularly given the energy crisis we're in now and how high energy bills are, more effort go towards liberalising onshore wind and solar and deploying those cheapest sources of energy to help bring bills down and make us less reliant on imported gas.
Well, you raised it. Let's do onshore wind, because the current position, as I understand it, is there is still a moratorium, in England at least, from this government on development of onshore wind.
Yes, and I think that does need to be looked at again. It was something that Liz Truss actually said in her growth plan that she would subject onshore wind in England to the normal planning process in England. I do think the problem that we have is that there's this continued perception that it's unpopular. And we know from poll after poll that actually onshore wind, even amongst Conservative voters, even amongst voters that live next to a wind farm, is actually enjoys large majorities of support.
I was going to bring Chris Venables in on this because, you know, that is the case, isn't it? That it's no longer as unpopular as people seem to believe.
I think that's right. And I think off the back of things like the heat waves last summer, the environment is a top three issue. This is an issue that people really want to see the government take serious action on. And I think as well, if you think about the 8 million people who are going to be living in fuel poverty this winter, the quickest, best thing we can do is invest in renewables and insulate homes. And so unblocking onshore wind is the simplest, best thing we can do.
If you guys had to take a sweepstake on whether we'll still see this moratorium, this blockage on onshore wind in a year's time, do you still be here?
I think we'll go, but I think local communities need to be able to veto it, and there needs to be incentives in terms of money off your energy bill in return for hosting it.
Is that the key, making it our energy, if you're a community, not a kind of imposed thing from outside, Chris?
I think that's right. I think MPs will hear from their constituents in their inboxes. I think the ban will be lifted over the next 6-12 months.
And
look, we're facing a cost of living crisis driven by high energy costs. We're facing an energy security crisis, and we're trying to get to net zero. So I can't see a plausible scenario where we will keep on imposing a blanket ban on the cheapest renewable energy technology. Just doesn't make sense.
Sam, can I pick up with you a point that Nick made, that regulation from government can, in fact, yield investment, can help business? Because the perception, particularly from some in the Tory party, is that regulation is always a dampener on growth.
I think sometimes we need regulation to create certainty about where policy is going, to create a level playing field as well, so that businesses that want to do the right thing, that want to develop the clean technologies that we'll need to hit our climate, hit our nature targets, can do so with the confidence that there is going to be a market there for these products. And I think, you know, particularly in the current fiscal situation that we're in with the public finances and the lack of spare capacity to put in public money, if we can create these regulatory drivers to get the private sector deploying technologies like heat pumps, like electric vehicles, we can actually drive a lot of the progress towards net zero without putting in lots of extra government spending, which I think we're going to need.
There is part of the Conservative Party that is very sceptical about net zero, the Net Zero Scrutiny Committee. How much power do they have, and has that power been increased or decreased by briefly having, I was going to say, the hand on the steering wheel, or maybe briefly backseat driving during Truss's administration, Sam?
I think most Conservative MPs, you know, would recognise the manifesto commitment in 2019 to deliver net zero. As I say, there are many,
but you're
slightly
avoiding the
MPs
question, because there is a constituency, and they briefly had quite a lot of influence, that don't agree with that.
Well, there is, but I say even within that net zero scrutiny group, I know that there are people who still stand by that manifesto commitment to deliver net zero. I welcome a discussion about how do we get the cheapest, the fairest way to net zero, and I think that would probably lead you to measures like unblocking onshore wind or solar or insulating more homes. So I think there are answers to some of the concerns that they raise, and I think the fact that even with Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak and all this political instability we've had, the Conservative Party has stayed the course in terms of its commitment to net zero and has stuck with its environmental commitments.
One thing I want to move on to just before we finish, of course, is, you know, there is an election in 2 years' time. It's worth pointing out that the Labour Party leader Keir Starmer recently said he wanted to double onshore wind, triple solar, quadruple offshore wind power, talking about us reindustrialising the country to be green. How do you think environment is going to play in the next election, Sam?
I think it's going to be a top issue. You know, we know from poll after poll that environment is one of the top three voter concerns across the UK. But not only that, it plays into lots of other issues that are in near the top of the public's priority list. For example, cost of living. It's because energy has gone up so much that we've not built enough renewable energy, not insulated enough homes, that we have such high cost of living. So I think it's going to be important. And I encourage and hope that there will be this virtuous competition between the parties, and the Conservative Party will see the importance of net zero and environmental leadership, not just in terms of its political opportunity, but also for the growth that it wants to drive, that it hopes will improve its poll ratings in the coming years.
Are we just wishful thinking, Chris, those of us in this room who want it to be a big issue?
I don't think we are. I mean, I think over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen the environment shoot up the agenda in Westminster. I can remember working in Westminster where no one talked about climate change, where we didn't talk about the Prime Minister going to COP. I think it's extraordinary, the change that has happened. I think, interestingly, Labour, leading now on this, on their pledge of a greener, fairer future, shows that as well. I think the kind of interesting one for me is, yes, we'll have a big conversation around climate and net zero. Will we be talking about nature? Will we be talking about farming? And if we can do that, if we can push nature up the agenda as well, I think that would be a real win.
And the one thing we've not mentioned today is that actually moving to net zero is a major source of job creation. And we're going to need to employ around 400,000 people to decarbonise the whole energy system. And we're looking at creating jobs in regions like Yorkshire and Humber, Wales, the West Midlands. Those are parts of the country that really need that investment and that job creation. So I think increasingly it's going to be an issue that matters to voters.
Nick Mollo, CEO of the Aldersgate Group, Chris Venables from Green Alliance, and Sam Hall, Director of the Conservative Environment Network. Thank you very much indeed.